It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the immigration principles being proposed by House Republicans and whether we could see immigration reform passed in the coming year.
First, over the past 5 years, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of sex offenders released from the state's Sand Ridge Secure Treatment Center in Mauston. WPR teamed up with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism to find out why.
Gilman Halstead kicks off a three-part news series that examines what life is like for the inmates behind the razor wire fences at Sand Ridge and how the patients there prepare for reintegration into the community.
Since the law was passed 20 years ago, the state has committed about 500 such offenders known as sexually violent persons. Two-thirds of them are still locked up at Sand Ridge. Deborah McCulloch is the director of the treatment center.
We are treating a very small percentage of sex offenders in Wisconsin, and that small percentage are the highest or most likely to reoffend in their lifetime.
For an offender to wind up at Sand Ridge, they have to be diagnosed with a mental disorder and a criminal history that makes it more likely than not that they will commit a new crime. Once an offender is committed to Sand Ridge, psychologists evaluate his progress in treatment each year and use historical data on recidivism to determine his risk level. Over the past 5 years, 114 have been released compared to only 31 in the previous five-year period. Staff at the center say the increase is partly due to the effectiveness of the treatment program. Lloyd Sinclair is in charge of community programs at Sand Ridge. He says only 5 of the 67 patients released between 1994 and 2010 have committed new sex crimes.
If we can have the kind of reoffense rates that we have with patients who've been out 4 or 5 years, we feel some sense of confidence, particularly how high risk our patients are. The evidence is of those who've been released, the treatment program has been beneficial.
But the increased releases are also driven by new data that show how often released sex offenders commit new crimes, and that rate has gone down nationally. Now the current patients at Sand Ridge are considered less likely to reoffend. Under a new state law signed in December, most offenders released from Sand Ridge will be under strict supervision. Take Larry. He was released this month after serving 19 years for sexual assault, more than 10 of them at Sand Ridge after completing his original prison sentence. Sand Ridge officials ask that we only use patients' first names. He's living in Rock County right now and still going to weekly therapy sessions, but he still can't walk the streets of his neighborhood without an escort.
Right now, I have activities such I can go out, have certain people come and pick me up, or I can do grocery shopping, clothing shopping, those sorts of things. But inside my home, I do a lot of studying, especially religious studying. I do a lot of exercising, just little things to try to keep myself busy. There's not much that I can do as of right now of getting out because of the way the law is written.
Even with the restrictions, Larry says for him, there are some pluses to being on supervised release.
I didn't want to live on the street or under a viaduct or something like that. I have a support team that is willing to help me get back on my feet, even though it's a process that I have to go through and these restrictions I got.
Sometime in early February, Larry will get a chance to visit with his family for the first time since his release. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In part two of this series, we'll take a harder look at the costs and benefits of releasing reformed sex offenders versus keeping them locked up, and how patients there are preparing themselves to get out and stay out. Meanwhile, you can see the full report beginning Sunday at wisconsinwatch.org and in newspapers around the state. It's one of the closest relationships two people can have, but only a very few people ever get to experience it. Being a twin can be a rewarding life experience, but that's not to say it can't cause some problems down the road.
Our next guest says that as kids, twins are often expected to depend on each other for their emotional needs. And because of that, they often find difficulties later in life when it comes to balancing being a twin and being an individual.
Here to talk about some of these challenges and how twins can overcome them is Joan Friedman. She's a psychotherapist specializing in twin issues, and she's a twin herself and a mother of twins, by the way. Her new book is The Same But Different: How Twins Can Live, Love, and Learn to Be Individuals. Joan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In the past, you've written about kids and for parents of kids who are twins. The new book is about adult twins. Why focus on them?
Well, after I finished writing the first book, I got so many calls from adult twins who were saying, why can't you write something for us? You know, there really isn't anything targeted specifically for adult twins who are just going through sort of normal developmental challenges. So it was such a wonderful opportunity for me to do research and also to use some of my own experience to help write a book that I hope can help a lot of other adult twins navigate issues and challenges that come up for them.
You introduced me to a new phrase. I'm the father of twins myself, by the way.
Oh,
I had not. Thank you. I had not encountered the concept of the twin mystique, or at least that phrase. What is that, and why is it a hurdle?
Well, I made the phrase, so that's possibly why you hadn't heard about it before. And for me, it means that most people idealize that it's being a twin is the best thing in the world. Lots of non-twins think that twins are lifelong telepathic friends forever, and they're never going to be alone, and they're always going to be taking care of one another. And while there are a lot of wonderful, mysterious, and magical parts of being a twin, I think the dark side of twinship oftentimes isn't discussed, because I've certainly had the experience myself. If someone comes up to me and says, oh, you have a twin, I go, uh-huh. Are you best friends? And I'll say, no, not really. We're sisters and we get along really well, but we're not best friends. And I can see their face just drop.
Oh,
they're
no.
So upset that I've burst their bubble. So my hope in writing the book was to let people know who have twins, live with twins, married to twins, that twins don't get along all the time, and it's not a bad thing. And actually, you can learn a lot from what doesn't go on well in your twinship and really develop into a healthier self.
You tell a lot of stories about twins in the book, and it seems like one of the basic problems is that a lot of them, the twins, have adopted that concept of the twin mystique. And when they don't get along or aren't best friends all their lives, they feel like they've failed or they're betraying their twin somehow.
That's exactly right. I can see you've gotten the grasp of the book. I'm so delighted. That is true. And the calls that I get are basically from the twin that's feeling successful. The twin that has a job or a boyfriend or she's, you know, achieved some wonderful thing in her life can never feel good about her own success, because if her sister is not in that same place, let's say her sister is depressed, unemployed, and doesn't have a relationship, the twin who's happy is so guilt-ridden and feels like she's betraying her sister, and it's so sad that she's not able to be happy for herself and still feel that she's connected to her sister.
Should it really, I guess, be that different from two non-twin siblings in that same situation?
You know, I'm often asked that question, and yes, I think there is a crucial difference. Growing up with a different age sibling, you automatically assume a lot is growing up. You know, you fight, yell, scream, but there is definitely differences that you get by being different ages. But same age siblings don't have that in that space in their relationship to be that open and that free and that maybe that argumentative. The twins have a much closer relationship because they're in each other's presence 24/7 for most of their lives until possibly they go to separate colleges. So it is very different. And they're also sharing everything. They're sharing supplies and mothers and fathers' attention and friends. And it's much more complicated.
We're talking about the issues facing twins, adult twins in particular, with psychotherapist Joan Friedman. Her new book is The Same But Different. We want to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a twin, or maybe the parent or sibling of twins? What kind of challenges do you see? How do twins, in your experience as a twin or knowing them, balance their individuality with their status as a twin? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org. Also, you can always post on the Central Time Facebook page, Central Time on WPR.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Joan Friedman, author of The Same But Different, about the challenges of being a twin, especially an adult twin. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a twin? How do you get along with your twin sibling? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go straight to the phones. We've got Jenny on the line in Milwaukee. Jenny, hi.
Hi.
Now, what's your story?
I have identical twin daughters, and as they were growing up, they were very close. But at some point, identical twins are completely different. One's very type A, very anal. The other's very laid back. And they separated at a point. They didn't want to be identical. And I think it kind of hurt both of their personalities and personas. And I'm just wondering if there's any way to get them back at this stage. They're both 26 right now.
All right. So can they rekindle that closeness they had? What do you think, Joan?
Oh, well, it's hard for me to make a professional pronouncement without a lot of details. But I guess I would have to sort of understand more about what the rift was about. And if you think as their mom that they have the communication skills and the capacity to talk through or work through their conflicts with one another.
Well, I don't think we need to get too deep into the details of this experience because, as you say, it's hard to diagnose things over the phone. But in general, when twins drift apart in life, what are the things that can bring them back together?
Well, I think if someone can articulate for both of them, maybe in the room, like your mom, for example, can sort of say, well, I know you're upset about this and I know you're upset about that, and let's sit down and try to talk about why the two of you haven't been able to get along lately. That's a possibility. Another thing is, seeing a therapist. You know, lots of times twins are too afraid to talk to one another about their issues with each other because they've grown up and they haven't learned how to really manage conflict or ambivalent feelings between each other. So if one goes and can talk to someone about what's bothering her, it's possible that then she'll feel more comfortable eventually coming and talking to her twin about it.
So for parents of younger twins now, looking ahead to adulthood, are there things they can do to pave the way for maybe the inevitable conflict that's going to come at some point in their lives?
Well, the inevitable conflict doesn't have to come, I believe, if parents of twins really try to provide separate experiences for each twin, in an age-appropriate time. Like, when they're littler, they can maybe go to different classes. Or later on, with our boys, we sent them to different day camps for a week. And then later on, when they were older, different night, overnight camps. We tried at each stage of their development to let them have time away from one another so that they could be more resilient on their own without feeling as if they always had to have their twin around to help them with issues that they were not able to do themselves. And this is so important because if twins aren't equipped with that resiliency by the time they go to college, it makes the college experience so much more difficult.
We'll go back to our phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jake with us in Milwaukee. Hi there, Jake.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I was just going to comment on what she was saying, and I totally agree. Me and my twin brother, we had separate classes all through growing up, and our mom kind of let us explore what we were interested in, if it was sports. We ended up having a lot of same interests, but we were really prepared for adulthood, and I went to a different college for a year. I went to the same college, and now I'm in grad school. And I moved to Arizona for a year, and I was totally fine being apart. But now we're back together, and we get along really great, and can go to each other for whatever.
Interesting.
So just having that separation as kids, it really helped.
Thanks a lot for sharing
wonderful.
That.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, good advice there, Joan.
I'm so happy I got a caller that agreed with me. How fortunate!
Well, is there an urge among parents of twins? I'll say when my girls were super young, I thought, splitting them up when they go to kindergarten, what a horrible thing. But then by the time kindergarten came along, I thought, what a great idea. But is there that urge for parents to really keep them together, dress them the same, always do the same things, treat them as equally as possible no matter what?
Well, I think parents are a little bit more enlightened these days, hopefully, than when I was growing up. But parents do get completely invested in the twin mystique. And in a sense, I think they do because there's two reasons. One is it gives them a lot of attention and they feel special. And then number two, I think parents are often shut out of the twin relationship. And I think that's because parents don't realize that they have to work really hard to make an attachment to both of those twins so that the twin-to-twin attachment is not as important as the parent-to-twin attachment. But I think parents who don't realize that are often left out, and it seems to them that the twin relationship is the most important thing, and so it all gets embellished in ways that are oftentimes unhealthy.
So if you treat, whether we're talking about parents or a friend even, if you treat them as a unit instead of individuals, they're probably going to respond back as a unit in a way.
Absolutely right. Well said.
Mm-hmm. Something else you talk about in the book that I wanted to make sure we get to is you write about twins who had trouble forming relationships, whether romantic relationships or close friendships with people,
mm-hmm.
because there's that comparison, at least in some people's minds, between the closeness of that other relationship and the twin relationship they grew up with.
That's exactly right. And it's so funny because my twin and I, Jane and I, were never separated until we went to college. Jane went to University of Wisconsin,
and I went
to University of Michigan. And we ended up sort of unknowingly replicating our twin relationship with roommates. So Jane found this very bossy, extrovert woman roommate who I think was sort of a replica of me. And I found at the University of Michigan this very shy, introverted person that I was taking care of like I felt I was taking care of Jane. So in many ways, unconsciously, we replicated our twin-like relationship. And oftentimes, you know, when twins start to date, you know, twins are used to having a roommate, their roommate, that can read their thoughts, that there's instant intimacy. And then they all of a sudden have to go to college and, you know, live with someone who doesn't treat them like their twin did. So they have to learn a whole different way of relating and a kind of a whole way of dealing with intimacy. It was so funny. This lovely gentleman I interviewed said he was an identical twin. And he said, when I was in high school, I was like a superstar. Everyone knew who my brother and I were, and we were great. And then when I went to college and I was by myself, he said, I lost my superpowers. Mm. So he really had to find out on his own how to make intimate attachments because he really never had to do that before. And it happens often, too, with marriages that twins look for someone they can have instant intimacy with, and we all know that you have to learn how to communicate really well to have positive intimacy. So it can be an issue.
All right, time for one more caller. We've got John with us in Windsor. Hi, John.
Yeah, my mom is a twin. She's 82 years old, and she had another set of twins in her family. She's the youngest of 14, and it was real interesting watching my mother and her twin sister growing up. They married exactly opposites. My dad is a minister. My uncle was an army officer, but they had the same number of kids. My mom had three girls and one boy, and my uncle had three boys and one girl. So, they separated for many years, and now they're in communication quite more often. And you know, it's really interesting. The whole family, they all had the same kind of characteristics. It wasn't really just the twins, but it was. What are your thoughts about kids of twins? Do you have any thoughts on how they're raised or anything?
Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, how did being a twin inform your parenting, maybe, Joan?
Well, I was so happy when I found out I was having twins because I felt I could raise my boys, who are now 25 years old, in a way that I wish Jane and I had been raised. And so it informed me a lot. And I made sure that I did three things with Johnny and David, which is we didn't tell them who was older. We made sure that we spent alone time with each of them. And when they were finally old enough to understand, I let them know that they were not able to go to the same college. So it informed me in many ways that I felt was important to help them develop their own individuality and their own separate selves.
Joan, in our last minute, can you leave us with maybe one key piece of advice for twins entering adulthood?
Well, maybe my advice would be more for people who know twins who are in adulthood, is to make sure you try to get to know them. Make sure that you don't expect them to, you know, be over the moon being a twin, and ask them about themselves and what's different about them and what their experience was like, and not to be disappointed or crestfallen if they tell you they're not best friends, because, you know, it's not the end of the world. It actually can be a good thing. It facilitates growth.
Joan, thank you so much for being with us today. Very interesting.
Thank you. It was a wonderful interview. I appreciate it.
That was Joan Friedman. She is a psychotherapist. She's worked with twins. She is a twin. She's the mother of twins. Her new book is The Same But Different: How Twins Can Live, Love, and Learn to Be Individuals.
Coming up after the news, a look at House Republicans and their ideas for immigration reform. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can follow us on various forms of social media. On Twitter, we are Central Time WPR. On Facebook, Central Time on WPR. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our Super Bowl edition of Food Friday.
First, Republican members of the House released a list of principles Thursday evening that they say will guide any bills they put forth on immigration reform.
Eyes have been on the House of Representatives for movement on immigration since the Senate passed a sweeping bipartisan reform bill last year. In a Congress that's had a lot of trouble coming together for bipartisan legislation, it looks like immigration reform might have a chance of happening this year.
Here to lay out what the GOP's principles are and how they might play out in legislation is USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this is not a bill that we're talking about here. Why did Republicans in the House craft these principles?
Exactly. These are principles that they laid out. Here we are a year into this. The Senate has already done its work. It's passed its bill. And the GOP has released principles. This is a big step. They wanted to put this out there. It's almost sort of like a way to just start a conversation with their own Republicans, with the chamber. They didn't want to put anything in bill form as of yet, as they say, because they kind of wanted to hear their thoughts. They wanted to talk it through. So this retreat that they were at this week was a good opportunity for them to do that, to sort of start things going, and eventually they think this will lead to a bill that or several bills that they think they can get through.
Who exactly is behind the principles?
Speaker John Boehner's office is they were directly responsible for getting this thing together. They worked with other leaders in the Republican Party there in the House, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor. These guys have been working on this for quite a while, I can tell you, and it was very hard to even put together this one-sheet piece of paper that just broadly outlines what they're hoping to do. But the big question there is what to do with the 12 million undocumented immigrants, and I can tell you that that's what's given them the most heartburn and why it took so long to even get to this point.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what is in this document. What does it lay out in terms of a pathway to citizenship, for example?
What it does, and understand, it's there's a lot of agreement between the House and the Senate on a lot of the smaller components that make up immigration reform, border security, granting more visas to high-tech workers, things like that. So it's this question of what a pathway like that should look like. That's been the most difficult thing. And what they came up with in the House, or what they're starting to look at, is allowing everybody to go on what they call a probationary status for a while. So those 12 million would be able to apply and stay here legally, work here legally. After a certain amount of time, that would turn into a more permanent sort of work permit that they can, again, work here, live here. And then the ones who have a relative who's a U.S. citizen, or who their employer sponsors them for a green card, they could then get in the back of the already existing line to get those green cards and begin that process.
It sounds like there are some rules, though, that might preclude certain individuals from becoming citizens. How does the document address undocumented immigrants who won't be eligible for citizenship?
Well, they don't get into that level of detail in that. Some of the Republican leaders, Ryan has talked about this in the last few days, and it's an idea that other members in the House have kind of been floating for a while, wherein the Senate bill, everybody would be able to the vast majority of the 12 million would be able to become legal and then get on that path to get a green card. By doing it the way the House is looking at, only allowing those who have a relative or an employer who can sponsor them for a green card, that reduces that number who can get citizenship at any point to about 5-6 million. So it really cuts in half and really diminishes the number of people who can ever really attain citizenship.
Border security has been a longtime concern for many Republicans. What do the principles say on that matter?
The principles on that one are very vague, but the House has already taken up a bill that was sponsored by a representative from Texas, Mike McCall. And what that does is it focuses on monitoring the border, on putting down more radars, on putting down more sensors so that Customs and Border Patrol officers can better know what's going on down there, who's coming over, where they're coming over, and so they can more quickly respond. And it provides that we start really measuring and getting some hard data on who's crossing over, how often they're crossing over, where they're crossing over. So sort of a more intelligent, I guess, is the way they like to phrase it, a smarter way of watching the border instead of just flooding the region with a bunch of guys running around in trucks.
Are Republicans 100% behind this in the House of Representatives, or are there some rifts here?
Not even close. This is going to be a very, very difficult process to try to get through the House. I could have had this discussion a year ago, the idea that we would have ended up being right where we are. The Senate got its work done, but it's that inability of a lot of people, a lot of Republicans in the House, to embrace anything that comes close to what they call amnesty for the undocumented immigrants. That's the big hurdle that's going to be the hardest thing to get over. Because you got a lot of Republicans in the House who, I mean, they just come from districts that don't have a lot of minorities. They don't have – immigration just isn't really a big issue for them. And a lot of them are worried about what happened way back in 1986, the last time that it was 3 million people who were undocumented immigrants at the time that were allowed to become citizens. And at the same time, there was this promise of border security, and obviously that has not happened. So a lot of them are very worried that it's going to be a repeat of that. And so that's what that's that fine line that Boehner's trying to walk right now, is appearing tough and figuring out some way to really secure that border and appeasing those Republicans that are very, very skeptical of going forward with this.
What has the Democratic response been to the principles so far, or even President Obama's reaction?
President today just applauded them for getting to work. There's going to be a lot of disagreements on a lot of the finer points. Once we see a bill, the committee hearings on this, I imagine, are going to be very contentious, are going to be very heated. But most Democrats, including the president, responded yesterday and today with just saying, hey, okay, good, we're starting, we're going with this. And there was a lot of fear that the Republicans were going to try to propose something where the undocumented immigrants would be able to get a legal status, but none of them would ever be allowed to become citizens. The fact that Boehner has come out and supported this idea that some of them, at least some of them, can eventually reach citizenship, that was a big sigh of relief for a lot of Democrats. It sort of makes their starting point in the negotiations a lot closer. So there's not that much of a divide, and it's not that big of a chasm that they got to get over.
Speaker Boehner maintains that an all-in-one overhaul is not the way to go. Is a bill similar to the Senate's out of the question at this point?
Well, I can tell. I mean, the House has absolutely rejected that Senate bill. It's been sitting there for 7 months, and they haven't even so much taken a look at it. What they want to do is what they call a piecemeal approach. So wherein the Senate bill addresses everything: border security, interior enforcement, the legal changes to the legal immigration system, this pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. What the House has already started doing to some degree is working individual bills. So like I mentioned earlier, Representative McCall's border security bill, that's been passed through a couple of committees and is teed up, ready to go on the House floor. They've passed four other bills that deal also with more interior enforcement and with reforms to the legal immigration system, and that seem to fit in with these principles that they laid out. Those have already also passed some committees. And so those are ready to go to the House floor. So the big sort of the big bill that we're all waiting for is the one that addresses that undocumented population. And so what they want to do is take each of them one by one, debate them each, pass them one by one, and they feel they can kind of control the process a little bit better that way. They're worried about these huge, huge bills that suddenly, you know, things just start appearing in them that you don't even know where they came from. So I think this is their way to sort of manage the process a little bit and keep more control over the, over it.
And earlier this week, in his State of the Union address, President Obama pointedly asked Congress to send him some legislation on immigration reform. So what, if anything, will we see over the course of this next year?
Yeah, the interesting thing is he said that, but it was one paragraph in his entire State of the Union address. He and I think that was for a purpose. I mean, he's trying to give the Republicans room. If he sat there and hammered on them for paragraph after paragraph and pushing them around, I think the Republicans would have taken that a little bit and kind of been a little upset with that. So now what we're seeing is there's a couple of windows in this year that they're looking at for possibly passing this. We got primary season coming up very, very soon, and a lot of folks think that we have to get past that primary season for Republicans who are on the fence, who may support this, but they're worried about getting, you know, facing a even more conservative candidate in their primary. So they think once they get past the primary, that's kind of a little window there where they can do something. And then they're even talking about the lame duck after the election as another opportunity, because it's going to be tough. They, you know, mixing an election year with an immigration vote is a very dangerous thing for a lot of folks. So you're seeing those are probably two of the windows where we could see some action.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
We've been speaking with Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today, about new principles on immigration reform released yesterday by House Republicans. Believe it or not, this is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Super Bowl is almost here, and grocery stores around the state will be hopping as football fans put their game day menus together.
In today's Food Friday, a chef joins us with some advice on what to serve for the big game. Chef Leah Kaplan is in the studio with us. She's the brand strategist for Field to Fork Consulting. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Do you try to tailor any of the food to represent the teams playing in the Super Bowl each year?
Yeah, I think that's the fun of it. I mean, there are usually some standbys, but I'm looking at the Super Bowl as the ultimate surf and turf, or the Battle of the Oysters, Pacific versus Rocky Mountain. And thinking of course, for Seattle, salmon, and Colorado, I can't not think beef and nachos. So sort of Super Bowl standbys, but they really make sense in this case.
Battle of the Oysters.
Yeah.
Rocky Mountain Oysters, that's a thing, isn't it? Or did I just make that phrase up in my head?
No, it is a thing.
And what is it? Is it gross?
What is that thing?
It's slightly gross.
Okay. Maybe we'll see. Well, let's hit those nachos first of all. What
yeah.
You know, I mean, there are lots of easy standby ways: chips, mm-hmm. little meat, little cheese, mm-hmm. and boom. What do you like to do to jazz up or add a unique touch to game day nachos?
So, one thing I like to do when I'm having a kind of casual party, like a Super Bowl party, is not necessarily do everything myself, but come up with a theme and then sort of assign. With some parameters, so you get something interesting. So if you do, for example, a nacho bar, and maybe I would actually make the tortilla chips myself, but then ask a few different people to bring cheese, some people to bring beans, and encourage them to be kind of experimental, maybe do some ground turkey chili and just keep that warm in a crock pot, and then you don't have the nachos that are delicious for 1 second and then they get cold, but everyone can kind of make them as they like them. And I like to do that with nachos, with soups, with chilies, that that kind of style of having people bring small components and ending up with sort of a grand experience.
So that spreads out the labor a little.
Yep. Yeah.
What other appetizers do you tend to think of when you're putting together a spread for the Super Bowl?
Well, when I love seafood and I love oysters, so I'm rooting for the Seahawks. And I love to do oysters Rockefeller in sort of a large dip style. So instead of doing an individual oyster shell with an individual oyster in the topping, I saute some onions and then add a bunch of spinach or kale, cook that, chop it up in the food processor, add a little bit of mayonnaise. That's kind of a little shortcut in making oysters Rockefeller. And then combine it with some chopped oysters, spread it in shallowly in a dish, and sprinkle Parmesan cheese or if you like crumbled bacon on it, and then warm that up and just dip bread or crackers.
I said, so you don't just eat that, you
right.
dip things in
yeah.
it. Okay. And that could be another thing where you ask people to bring different things to dip in.
Exactly. Yeah. I like, there's a northern Italian dish which has nothing to do with the Super Bowl called bagna calda, meaning warm bath. And it's garlic, a little bit of anchovies, butter, and olive oil. And you just kind of keep a flame under it and keep it warm. And you can dip vegetables, bread, hard-boiled eggs, sliced meat, fish. And that's a great thing that really appeals to everyone if you don't tell them there are anchovies in it.
Is it best to stick with appetizers and hors d'oeuvres, or what can we make in the form, in the way of maybe a main course for the football game?
Chili always comes to mind. I'm not a fan of ground meat chilies so much, unless it's on nachos. I like cubed meat, whether it's beef or pork, and just slow cooked. And chili powder in and of itself, that sort of generic chili powder, doesn't excite me too much. So I usually will use some guajillo chilies or chipotle chili powder or the chipotle and adobo in the little cans, just to get some excitement and complexity. Sliders are a fun thing to do, or of course full burgers, but you could do veggie sliders, turkey sliders, beef sliders. And again, you can ask people to bring some different toppings.
Seems like given the season and the fact you want to keep stuff warm over a long period of time, this like cries out for crock pot cookery,
yeah.
doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's, you know, when the Midwest is really in its culinary glory is around Super Bowl time. And then drink-wise, they're, you know, Seattle, we think coffee. So something I had in Italy and then I had again in Greece this summer, and you might know it by another name at a very common coffee shop around the world, but it's a Freddo cappuccino, and it's you take either espresso or very strong coffee and then just blend that with ice and milk. And if you want to add a little rum to it or a little vodka and make it alcoholic, but it's delicious and it tastes much richer than it actually is.
So if we want to do a coffee theme for Seattle, one worry I'd have is the game is at 5 or something. We're going to keep everybody awake all night. We could get the Big Lebowski fans on board, a little coffee liqueur in a white Russian.
Right.
That
right.
would make a nice Super Bowl drink.
Yes, it would. And the fans are going to be up all night anyway.
That's true.
But you could do it decaf.
Oh, yeah, right. I always forget that exists.
Yeah.
In the radio business, that's not a thing. You know, I think about some of the appetizers that I've had at Super Bowl parties, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't say they're high quality. And people whip out the Velveeta cheese or the mini wieners and all these things that aren't, you know, necessarily gourmet.
Yeah.
But it's probably because we're strapped for time.
Mm. Right.
What tips do you have for making good food but not taking all day to do it?
Well, the two things that we've mentioned, one is a crock pot. So literally you can do it while you sleep or in the morning and then spend the day vacuuming or whatever it is you enjoy before a party. And then spreading out the work. And that also, you know, spreads out the financial obligations. So instead of having a whole bunch of inexpensive, low quality food, you can just move it up a notch by distributing the wealth.
Oh, we had a Seattle cocktail. What's I don't know what I'd think of for a Denver, Colorado cocktail.
Well, beer comes to mind pretty quickly, and certainly for the Seahawks, Washington State wines, sparkling wines, still wines. But you could do like a clementine or tangerine juice or orange juice. You know, you could do it with gin and tonic, which is a nice twist on the gin and tonic, or of course a screwdriver, or just take whole peeled oranges and put them in the blender with a little bit of ice. And again, you have this sort of rich, frothy thing that is really just citrus and water.
So any last tips for the Super Bowl? Oh, wait, cheese. I forgot the cheese. What's a fun way to present our Wisconsin cheese at a Super Bowl, even though our Packers aren't there?
Well, clearly cutting it into the shape of a football.
Oh, okay.
That would be my number one. And if you are a Broncos fan, I would definitely go with orange cheddar.
Okay, yeah, for the team color.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Leah Kaplan. She's a chef and brand strategist for Field to Fork Consulting, joining us today for Food Friday.